Amazon will also be facing pressure from Sony. Today, Sony is introducing two digital reading devices, the Touch and the Pocket. They'll compete with Amazon's Kindle, NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
The Touch has a touchscreen panel with a built-in dictionary and sophisticated note-taking capabilities, but it's the Pocket that's likely to stir interest. Its screen is 5 inches, smaller than other devices, and at $199, less expensive, too. Sony Vice President Brennan Mullen.
At $199, we hope to really break a new barrier in terms of pricing and hopefully make digital reading available to a larger audience.
Sarah Rotman Epps, a media analyst for Forrester Research, says the $199 price is a coup for Sony. But she adds, the market for these readers is still limited.
This is not Joe Schmo on the corner. These are for people who really love to read and read a lot of books. And for that segment, $199 is a great price point.
Sony is also bringing down the price of books available at its e-book store from $11.99 to $9.99, the current price of a book at Amazon's Kindle store. And through a partnership with Google, Sony's customers will have access to 1 million public domain books for free. But the Sony readers still won't have the same wireless capability that the Kindle has. Sony Vice President Brennan Mellon says they're working on that. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This year, a lot of people heading off on vacation are not packing a pile of books in their luggage. Instead, they're tucking away their digital readers in backpacks and purses. More people are getting used to reading e-books on devices like the Sony Reader or the Amazon Kindle. But some recent news about the Kindle made a lot of us wonder about the future of books. So we invited NPR's Lynn Neary to join us this morning. Lynn, you cover books and publishing for NPR, so do you have a Kindle or an e-book reader?
Actually, I don't, Linda. In fact, my cubicle at NPR and my night table at home are loaded down with good old-fashioned books. Because even though I've actually seen the Kindle work and I've talked to a lot of people who love it, I still can't imagine reading some of my favorite novels on the Kindle. What about you?
I love it. It's especially nice for traveling. I really do not leave home without it. But I did have a very peculiar experience with Kindle. I was reading a book, and all of a sudden I was back at the beginning of the book, so I thought I'd punch some button somehow. But no, what I had was a book in two pieces. Then I thought, maybe the second part of the book, if I start reading it, it'll go to the end. So I started doing that, and all of a sudden, it was gone. That book was just gone right in front of my face. It was gone.
Well, it is weird, but as I think you know, you are not alone in discovering that Amazon can take away as quickly as it can deliver on the Kindle. And just recently, Amazon surprised some customers when it deleted George Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm from their Kindles because of copyright issues. Now, Amazon did apologize, but it turns out that it's happened with a few other books before. And all that raises the question, what exactly does it mean to own a book in the digital age? What makes a book a book? Is it a physical object or a matter of the mind? I talked with a number of e-book converts like yourself about this. One of them was Patricia Sullivan, a librarian at the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library here in D.C.
There's a lot of, oh, I can't believe it, you're a librarian and you're using an e-reader.
Now, Sullivan owns a Sony reader. At the moment, it's the Kindle's biggest competitor. She likes the Sony device because she can easily download free books at the D.C. library, and she loves its portability. But sometimes she says it's no substitute for the printed page. After a day at work, she's sick of looking at a screen and much prefers to snuggle up with a real book.
It's hard to curl up with your Sony reader at night, you know, and you won't see an author signing a Sony reader at a signing. So I don't think books are going to go out of fashion anytime soon. I just think they can coexist.
I curl up with my Kindle all the time.
Larry Bowen, an administrator at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, thought that he would miss books when he bought his Kindle, but that hasn't happened. He thinks his transition to digital reading has been eased by his experience with downloading music to his iPhone. When he first got the iPhone, Bowen thought he'd keep playing his albums.
Absolutely, I did. And I don't know exactly when the switch flipped, but now I just can't imagine pulling an album out and actually playing it as an album rather than bringing it up and shuffling or picking out a particular song. And I just can't imagine it anymore.
In the same way, Bowen says, reading on his Kindle is completely satisfying, but he does still crave books for another reason.
I actually still have a weakness for Star Wars books, and I have bought them for years, so I can't stop buying the physical book now, yet I read it on the Kindle.
So for Bowen, books have already become a collector's item. They're objects he cares about, but mainly they sit on his bookshelves. As far as Jonathan Gutenberg is concerned, that's just one more thing to collect dust.
From my perspective, I'm not necessarily wed to owning something that has to sit on a shelf.
Gutenberg is a consultant to media and technology companies. He reads on his Kindle, his iPhone, and his computer.
What makes up a book depends upon the content matter, depends upon the use, and depends upon the individual and how they perceive it.
A book, says Gutenberg, is more than just a physical object.
It's the ability to access the content, the ability to read it wherever I want, and the ability to search it. I mean, I think there's huge value in being able to find things within books in a much easier fashion than you can in a printed book.
Graphic designer Robert Fabricant goes a step further. He doesn't own an e-reader yet, but he is intrigued by them, both as a reader and as a designer. He talks about e-books as metaphors that may or may not need the same features as a traditional book.
Pages, chapters, all those things are very necessary in paper. They're not in an e-book reader.
In an e-book, Fabricant says, the page as we know it doesn't have to exist unless you want it to.
One of the challenges for the e-book readers has been to try and represent the page you're on. Right? And defining pages that don't match the printed page in terms of the number of characters, trying to sort of show you in some progress bar where you are in the book. I mean, all those things are interesting design problems. And the minute you buy into the metaphor, you have to decide how literally you're going to take those on.
Just as electronic readers require new thinking about book design, says Fabricant, so do we have to rethink what it means to own a book. Because maybe, he says, we don't need to have so many actual books.
When I go up to the room in our house, I live in a brownstone in Brooklyn, that has our bookshelves, I stare at a lot of books, right? I think really that the number of books I need to own is relatively small to the number of books I want to read.
And the question of ownership takes us back to the story that prompted this exploration, the realization that Amazon can take back a book without notice. Librarian Patricia Sullivan says that's likely to make the skeptics hang on more tightly to their traditional books.
It would definitely influence how they think about it because, you know, if you can have your books removed, what's the real point?
So, Linda, I'm curious, after you had your book removed, did you think differently about your Kindle and about books?
I don't think I did. I don't have any particular expectation of privacy.
And do you still read both on your e-reader and traditional books?
I do. I read regular books all the time.
And do you curl up with your Kindle?
You know, I do. And every once in a while, I find myself brushing the top right-hand corner with my hand like I'm going to turn the page. I'm so into it that it just doesn't register as different from a book.
Well, Linda, maybe you're starting to convince me.
Thanks very much for coming in, Lynn. NPR's Lynn Neary covers books and publishing for NPR. Now, in fairness to Amazon, I should say, Steve, that just as quickly as the defective book was zapped away, my account was magically credited. So in this brave new digital world, books can appear quickly and so can money.
I suppose so, although I'm waiting to find out if Fahrenheit 451 is hot enough to burn a Kindle. Anyway, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
An Arizona business is bucking the recession by offering to take kids off parents' hands for a few hours. Game Truck is a mobile video arcade that offers high-tech parties in the back of air-conditioned trailers that come to your home. And this summer, business is hot. Arizona Public Radio's Jillian Ferris-Cole reports.
Timbo Roeder is celebrating his 11th birthday with 16 friends and a fierce game of Halo 3.
Run!
The boys sprawl out on a long leather sofa under blue LED party lights, game controllers in hand. They are completely sucked in to the alien shootout and heavy metal music blasting from four enormous TVs in front of them. 11-year-old partygoer Quentin Zapata explains the game the boys are playing.
Halo is about Spartans and elites. Spartans are not friends with the elite. They had to team up to defeat the Halo, which wiped out every last Spartan except for one.
Today, Quentin is excited to be the last Spartan standing, but he's even more excited about playing Halo 3 for the first time with more than one other person, which is how he plays it at home.
It's awesome!
And it's cold inside the 50-foot game truck, which is one of the business's selling perks, especially on a day like today, where it's 115 degrees in the shade at the Roeder family home in Tempe.
I sometimes describe it as like your dream living room on wheels.
That's 43-year-old Scott Novus, founder of Game Truck. A longtime video game designer and arcade lover, Novus says the idea for the business came to him in a flash at a friend's party.
It was a 36-year-old friend of mine dragging an Xbox off to a LAN party in a garage. The hassle of setting all that up to sit in a garage for a week and play the game, and it was like light bulb. What if we made that effortless for people? What if we made it all you had to do was show up and play?
So Novus designed a custom air-conditioned trailer that he could pull with his pickup truck and decked it out with the latest video game technology. His initial investment in 2006 was about $100,000 for one truck. Since then, Game Truck has turned into a multi-truck, multi-state franchise, with each rig pulling in about $10,000 a month. A two-hour party, like Timbo's, costs about $300.
We call it a mobile video game theater. We've got the best sound, the best controllers, the best TVs. There's just never an excuse not to play.
But since the average American kid indulges in about 7 hours of screen time every day, this new business begs the question, is it okay to make money by putting kids on their rear ends for another few hours? Scott Novus says absolutely.
What we really focus on is what we call social video gaming. The energy level inside the truck is fantastic. The kids are jumping around, they're interacting.
There's definitely excitement at Timbo Roeder's Game Truck party, but there isn't really too much physical activity to speak of. From his spot in the middle of the leather couch, Timbo says he actually wanted a sportier-type birthday.
My original idea was paintball, but then it was too expensive, so I went with Game Truck.
It's also too hot for paintball. Imagine what shape Timbo's party guests would be in after running around the desert at high noon in full military-style gear. As it is, Timbo says he's already wiped out from too much pizza and soda.
I feel like sitting on the couch and watching TV.
And though Timbo has all the time in the world for a nap, Game Truck's still got work to do. It has three more parties to throw before the end of the day. For NPR News, I'm Jillian Ferris Cole in Tempe.
Cash for Clunkers is not only supposed to boost the auto industry and the economy, it's also supposed to benefit the environment. All this month, we'll be examining some of the things Americans are doing or buying to preserve the environment and curb global warming. Today, in the first of our series, NPR's Christopher Joyce takes on this question: is trading in your old car for a new one as helpful to the planet as it might seem?
Robert Hemsley was one of the first customers to take advantage of the Cash for Clunkers deals offered at Sheehy Auto Stores in Annapolis, Maryland. Hemsley says he wasn't thinking about the environment when he went into the showroom.
Just saving money, staying alive, making a buck, paying my bills. I had a Chevy van, 97, I guess 12 years old, 224,000 miles, and it got 14 miles to the gallon.
Hemsley used his government voucher to buy a Nissan Cube, which gets about 30 highway miles on a gallon of regular. He says he'll cut his gas costs by almost two-thirds. But even before Hemsley drove out of the lot, his new car had actually added carbon dioxide, or CO2, to the atmosphere. That's because it takes electricity to make a new car and fuel to ship it.
The estimates vary, but it's somewhere between 3 and, say, 12 tons of CO2 are produced for every car you make.
William Chimides runs the Nicholas School for the Environment at Duke University. He says you have to drive a while before you save enough fuel to offset that new car carbon.
Our estimates are, depending on how much you drive, of course, that it's going to take you years or so.
For example, he calculates that if you trade in an 18-mile-per-gallon clunker for a 22-mile-per-gallon new car, it would take 5.5 years of typical driving to offset the new car's carbon footprint.
On the other hand, the Cash for Clunkers deal for trucks, you're really beginning to talk something like 8 years to make it up.
Engineer Chris Hendrickson at Carnegie Mellon University pioneered the calculation for the carbon costs of a new car. It's called a life cycle analysis. He says you have to cast a wide net to capture the true footprint.
That includes both the manufacturer, the assembly itself, but also the supply chain associated. Things like manufacturing the batteries, manufacturing the tires, transporting all those components around.
Of course, the bigger the mileage improvement from your old car to the new one, the more gas you save and the faster you work off the new car's carbon footprint. If you trade in a 20-mile-per-gallon car for a Prius, for example, that gets about 50 miles per gallon, it saves so much gas that you can offset the Prius's footprint in about a year and a half. But a 20-mile-per-gallon car does not qualify as a clunker, so no government voucher. And people with big cars tend to be buying new cars that are still pretty big, according to an executive at Xi Auto. He says more of their customers are opting for modest trade-ups, close to the 4-mile-per-gallon minimum improvement that's allowed for cars in Cash for Clunkers. Other auto analysts say they're seeing plenty of deals for new cars that get 10 miles a gallon more. But either way, it's not enough for Dan Becker of the Safe Climate Campaign.
The problem is the auto industry hijacked this law so it doesn't get the better ones on the road. All it does is replace old clunkers with new clunkers.
Becker says the Cash for Clunkers program is not creating a market for the most fuel-efficient cars. He notes that the original legislation had tougher mileage requirements, and he says the government would have done better by subsidizing people who buy cars that are 25% more fuel-efficient than the kind they're driving now. Even SUVs would qualify.
So you could, for example, buy a Ford Escape Hybrid, not something to sneeze at, and you'd trade in a clunker and drive off with a much more efficient vehicle.
Environmental analysts point out that only 2 years from now, new cars are supposed to get an average of 27 miles per gallon. That's 5 more than required by the Cash for Clunker program. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
In 5, 4, 3, 2.
I know, you see, somehow the world will change for me and be so wonderful.
That's the start of iCarly, one of the most popular children's shows on television, seen on Nickelodeon in the United States and in Great Britain, Canada, and scores of other countries. Here to talk about it now are Queenie Kim. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Tanya Jo Miller.
Hi, Scott.
They are co-creators of the podcast Cyber Frequencies. They're at member station 89.3 KPCC in Los Angeles. And what is iCarly? And what's it have to do with the web?
So iCarly is a show on Nickelodeon, and it's about a group of friends making a web show. And it's making kids want to be web stars these days more than movie stars.
Actually, as you know, Scott, Cyber Frequencies, as you noted, is a podcast, and we're also a radio column here at KPCC. We cover the web and technology, but we're not focusing on the experts so much as how you, me, the kid down the street, the teacher, are thinking and creating content on the web.
The biggest stars these days on the web are just regular people, and shows like iCarly reflect that. Here's a clip of a couple budding young web stars. I spoke to 7-year-old Ocelot and his 6-year-old cousin, Lola.
It's about 3 friends. They do a website called iCarly. And his brother Spencer makes, like, crazy sculptures. Just crazy.
Can you show me?
Yeah.
If you go on my computer...
I admire you. Her computer is much better.
There's iCarly.com.
What do you like about it?
When you click on the red button, you get your home page.
Do you want to be on the internet?
I do. And you say, why do you want to be on?
Okay, why do you want to be on the internet?
Because I want to have lots of fans, and it makes me a little bit shy, but it makes me really
happy. Wait, are we going to have real fans?
Yes.
Are you going to be on the internet?
Parents, as I don't have to tell you, get a little bit concerned with their youngsters navigating the web.
That's true. Even, for example, Ocelot's mom was really concerned about this.
And so what we did was, she had some concerns about, like, should my kid be on the web? Is it safe? All that sort of stuff that I'm sure I've been hearing a lot of parents talk about. And so we sought out the advice of a kindergarten teacher named Maria Nee, and she's from Deerfield, New Hampshire. She actually blogs with her students, and she's been teaching for more than 20 years, but she's really embraced the internet and made it a core part of her curriculum. And where she comes down on this is that she has no patience for educators who don't incorporate technology into their classrooms, because, as she points out, although a lot of parents sort of think of the internet sort of like TV as entertainment, it's really becoming the primary source of information these days.
Yeah, and if your kids miss out on that, I mean, that's kind of, if they don't know how to navigate the web, that's kind of a problem. She doesn't say that there are no dangers for kids on the web, but she thinks that you should not avoid them, but actually teach the kids to navigate these dangers and to, you know, be safe on the web.
I take the kids on field trips to Boston. We have to learn about how to be safe in the city. And just the same, we have to know how to be safe using this online environment. Yes, there's always someone who's going to click another button or by mistake hit a button. So I need to tell them, when you get to something that makes you feel a little nervous, shut the monitor off and then go tell a teacher.
Hmm. Of course, you're less worried about the kid who gets nervous than the kid who gets fascinated if they see something.
But it does, you know, you do hear parents a lot, like, I mean, I do notice that parents sort of ascribe motive to kids, you know, and what I really liked about that clip is that, you know, just sometimes it happens, and we just got to teach kids when, just like in real life, if a stranger approaches you or a weird thing comes on your screen, you know, don't get mad at them, just teach them, what do you do, turn off the screen, go to a parent, you know, and tell them what's happening.
Queenie Kim and Tanya Jo Miller, they're co-creators of CyberFrequencies.com. That's part of Maker's Quest, a project of the Association of Independence in Radio and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Do you have any questions about your child and the net? You can go to npr.org/soapbox, and you can post questions for the kindergarten teacher and blogger Maria Nee. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for All Tech Considered. Today we bring you two very different technology pioneers. One is sculptor Tim Tate. He's based in Washington, D.C. And you may not know his name, but his work is all over, including the Smithsonian. And we'll find out more about him in just a moment. The other is entrepreneur Craig Newmark. He's based here in California, and you definitely know his work. It's called Craigslist. In a little over a decade, Craigslist has become the largest source of classified advertising in the world. The site is now in 50 countries, and it has more than 20 billion page views a month. I recently spoke with Craig Newmark, trying to get a sense of the man behind the list.
I am very much a nerd. Grew up wearing a plastic pocket protector and thick black glasses. And I had the social skills associated with that stereotype. Been trying to grow out of it for a long time, ever since October of 72, when I realized that, well, couldn't be everyone else that had communication problems with me. It had to be reverse.
Tell me about how you got to California. You grew up in New Jersey. You worked for IBM for a while. Came out west.
The deal is that after 40 years on the East Coast, I figured I needed a big change, someplace I might be happy. Looked around a little bit, figured that San Francisco offered me my best chances. On leaving IBM, I got myself a job at Charles Schwab.
And then how did you come up with the idea of Craigslist?
I had a single good idea of an event list for San Francisco area. Then I listened to suggestions and did something about them. Nowadays, the guy who runs Craigslist, Jim Buckmaster, does the same thing, and he does a better job than I ever did.
So what do you do now?
Well, customer service. 14 years of it changes you a lot. You listen to people more. You try to empathize more. It feels right. It feels like an expression of a personal commitment to the community. And it's one way of staying in contact with what's real.
On a serious note, though, Craigslist has been the subject of some unflattering press and some after some really horrific stories came out, series of killings, where the perpetrators lured their victims on Craigslist. And some people were accusing you and the site of profiting from prostitution for the erotic ads that you run on your site. And you've agreed to put in some barriers, but
But some say you haven't done enough to police your site, that you could do a lot more. What do you say to them?
I don't know if anyone is saying that right now. We've done a great deal. It's documented on our blog.
But you do have adult ads on the site.
Yes, we do. It's all addressed on the blog.
Can you summarize it for us here?
Take a look at the blog there.
Okay, I'll do that.
There's been a great deal of misreporting in the area. One thing I'm passionate about when it comes to the news industry is the need for fact-checking.
Help us correct the facts, then.
It's in the blog.
I found the blog post about those erotic ads on Craigslist after searching the site quite extensively. Here's part of what was written on May 13th. As of today, for all U.S. Craigslist sites, postings to the erotic services category will no longer be accepted. And since then, the category has been replaced with a new one. It's called Adult Services for legal adult service providers. I asked Newmark if the controversy has changed the way he looks at the web.
There is one pertinent issue that applies to the entirety of the Internet. It's the tension between anonymity and accountability. Right now, on the net, it's very easy to be pretty much anonymous, and yet there are times when you would like someone to have some accountability, let's say if they're spamming or committing fraud. I've observed that in life offline or online, people are overwhelmingly good and trustworthy. There are very few bad people out there, but they're good at making noise and good at making their presence known, whether they're extremists or crooks or whatever.
Finally, I asked Craig Newmark about the place that helped make him and Craigslist what they are today.
Let's say there's this Silicon Valley culture, which kind of gets to us in a number of different ways. There's a culture of collaboration in Silicon Valley. People work with each other, to some extent, even if you might be competitors. And also in Silicon Valley, there's a great acceptance of a failure in the sense that there's some expectation that you'll start a venture. You may succeed, you may fail. There's no stigma attached to it. You just start on something new after you fail. People are trying to figure out how we can do better, what are the source of the problems, and so on.
Craig Newmark, founder of Craigslist, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.